no one had really wanted anything to do with this junk, which held out the promise of a whole new world we knew nothing about, but that as far back as 1947, the government had decided to keep an absolute secret. Career after career of anyone in government who'd even hinted at the big dark secret of Roswell was pulverized by whoever was behind this operation. And although I knew far more than I'd ever admitted to myself, I would never be the one to shoot off my mouth. But now this file, what I would eventually call the nut file to General Trudeau, had come into my possession, and as the ensuing weeks turned into a month, I gradually figured out where some of the puzzle pieces fit. First, there were the tiny, clear, single-filament, flexible, glass-like wires twisted together through a kind of gray harness as if they were cables going into a junction. They were narrow filaments, thinner than copper wire. As I held the harness of the strands up to the light from my desk, I could see an eerie glow coming through them as if they were conducting the faint light and breaking it up into different colors. When the personnel at the retrieval site in the desert outside of Roswell pulled this piece out of the wreckage of the delta-shaped object, they thought it was some sort of wiring device. A harness is what they said. Or maybe some of them thought it was a junction box or an electrical relay. But whatever they thought it was, they believed there was nothing like it on this planet. As I turned the object over in my hand, I figured from the way the individual filaments flexed back and forth but didn't break, and the way they were able to conduct the light beam along their length, they were a wire of some sort. But for what purpose? I didn't have a clue. Then there were the thin, 2-inch-around, matte gray, oyster cracker-shaped wafers of a material that looked like plastic, but had tiny roadmaps of wires barely raised, etched along the surface. They were the size of a 25-cent piece, but the etchings on the surface reminded me of squashed insects with their 100 legs spread out at right angles from a flat body. Some were more rounded or elliptical. It was a circuit. Anyone could figure that out by 1961, especially when you put it under a magnifying glass, but from the way these wafers were stacked on each other, this was a circuitry unlike any other I'd ever seen. I couldn't figure out how to plug it in and what kind of current it carried, but it was clearly a wire circuitry of a sort that came from a larger board of wafers on board the flying craft. My hand shook ever so slightly as I held these pieces, not because they themselves were scary, but because I was awed, just for a few seconds, about the momentous nature of this find. It was like an architectural treasure trove, the discoveries of some long-departed culture, a Rosetta Stone, even though whoever crashed onto the desert floor was still very active and roaming around our most secret Army and Air Force bases. I was most interested in the file descriptions accompanying a 2-piece set of dark elliptical eyepieces as thin as skin. The Walter Reed pathologist said they adhered to the lenses of the extraterrestrial creature's eyes and seemed to reflect existing light even in what looked like complete darkness, so as to illuminate and intensify images in the darkness to allow their wearer to pick out shapes. The report said that the pathologist at Walter Reed Hospital, who autopsied one of these creatures, tried to peer through them in the darkness to watch the one or two Army sentries and medical orderlies walking down a corridor adjacent to the pathology lab. These figures were illuminated in a greenish orange, depending upon how they moved, but the pathologists could see only their outer shape, and when they got close to each other, their shapes blended into a single form. But they could also see the outlines of furniture, and the wall, and objects on desktops. Maybe, I thought as I read this report, soldiers could wear a visor that intensified images through the reflection and amplification of available light, and navigate in the darkness of a battlefield with as much confidence as if they were walking their sentry posts in broad daylight. But these eyepieces didn't turn night into day. They only highlighted the exterior shapes of things. There was a dull, grayish, silvery, foil-like swatch of cloth among these artifacts that you could not fold, bend, tear, or wad up, but that bounded right back into its original shape without any creases. It was a metallic fiber with physical characteristics that would later be called super tenacity. But when I tried to cut it with scissors, the arms just slid right off without even making a nick in the fibers. If you tried to stretch it, it bounced back. But I noticed that all the threads seemed to be going in one direction. When I tried to stretch it widthwise instead of lengthwise, it looked like the fibers had reoriented themselves to the direction I was pulling in. This couldn't be cloth, but it obviously wasn't metal. It was a combination, to my unscientific eye, of a cloth woven with metal strands that had the drape and malleability of a fabric and the strength and resistance of a metal. I was on top of some of the most secret weapons projects at the Pentagon, and we had nothing like this, even under the wish list category. There was a written description and a sketch of another device, too, like a short, stubby flashlight, almost with a self-contained power source that was nothing at all like a battery. The scientists at Wright Field who examined it said they couldn't see a beam of light shoot out of it, but when they pointed the pencil-like flashlight at a wall, they could see a tiny circle of red light, but there was no actual beam from the end of what looked like a lens to the wall, as there would have been if you were playing a flashlight off on a distant object. When they passed an object in front of the source of the light, it interrupted it, but the beam was so intense that the object began smoking. They played with this device a lot before they realized it was an alien cutting device, like a blowtorch. One time they floated some smoke across the light, and suddenly the whole beam took shape. What had been invisible suddenly had a round, micro-thin, tunnel-like shape to it. Why did the inhabitants of this craft have a cutting device like this aboard their ship? It wasn't until later when I read military reports of cattle mutilations in which entire organs were removed without any visible trauma to the surrounding tissue that I realized that the light beam cutting torch I thought was in the Roswell file was actually a surgical implement, just like a scalpel that was being used by the aliens in medical experiments on our livestock. Then there was the strangest device of all, a headband almost, with electrical signal pickup devices on either side. I could figure out no use for this thing whatsoever unless whoever used it did so as a fancy hairband. It seemed to be a one-size-fits-all headpiece that did nothing, at least not for humans. Maybe it picked up brainwaves like an electroencephalogram and projected onto a chart. But no private experiment conducted on it seemed to do anything at all. The scientists didn't even determine how to plug it in or what its source of power was because it came with no batteries or diagrams. There were nights I'd spread these articles all around me as if they were indeed Christmas presents. There were nights when I'd just take one thing out, turn it around, until I almost memorized what it looked like from different angles before putting it back. The days were passing, and without having been told directly by Trudeau, I knew that he was getting anxious. We'd sit at meetings together when other people were around and he couldn't say anything, and I could almost hear his insides burst. There were times when we were alone, and Trudeau almost didn't want to broach our shared secret. Outside the Pentagon, there was a battle starting up all over again, set to rage just as it had during the Truman and Eisenhower presidencies. Whose intelligence was accurate? Whose was truthful? Who was trying to manipulate the White House? And who believed that by coloring or twisting facts, he could change the course of history? John Kennedy was leading a young administration capable of making extraordinary mistakes. And there were people at the heart of his administration whose views of how the world should work were inspiring them to distort facts, misstate intentions, and disregard obvious realities in the hope that their views would prevail. Worse, there were those deep within a secret government, within the government, who had been placed there by the spy masters at the Kremlin. And it was those individuals we had the greatest reason to fear. Right now, Army R&D had stewardship over these bits and pieces of foreign technology from Roswell. How long we would have them, I did not know. So over a late-night pot of coffee in General Trudeau's office, he decided that we would move this material out to defense contractors, out to where scientists would see it, and where, under the guise of top secrecy, it would be in the system before the CIA could stow it, where no one would find it except the very people we were trying to hide it from. "This is the devil's plan, General," I said to Trudeau that night. "What makes you think we can get away with it?"
"Not we, Phil," he said.
"You. You're the one who's going to get away with it. I'll just keep them off your back long enough until you do." Now, all I could think about was what I'd seen that night in 1947. And worse, what in the world was I going to do with all this stuff next? I'd asked myself why me hundreds of times since that night in the Pentagon. Asked why, after 14 years and my experience at Fort Riley, I had become the inheritor of the Roswell file. But I had no answers then, and no answers now. If General Trudeau had meant for this to happen when he took over R&D 3 years before I got there, I'll never know. He never gave me any reasons, only orders. But since he was the master strategizer, I sometimes think he believed I must have had some experience with alien encounters and wouldn't be spooked by working with the technology from the Roswell file. I never asked him about it, as strange as that seems, because the military being what it is, you don't ask, you simply do. So, now as then, I don't question. I only remember that I went forward from that night to put into development as much of the Roswell file as I could and believed that whatever happened, I was doing the right thing. Chapter 4. Inside the Pentagon, at the Foreign Technology Desk. The Pentagon never sleeps. And neither did I in those first few weeks at the R&D Foreign Technology Desk, as I racked my brain to come up with a strategy I could recommend to my boss. Amidst the constant 24-hour motion of an office building where someone is always working, I spent more time at my desk than I did at home. Evenings, weekends, early mornings before the sunrise set the windows across the river in Washington, an orange blaze, you could find me staring at the four-drawer file cabinet against my corner wall. I'd fiddle with the combination lock, sometimes so absorbed in coming up with a strategy for these strange artifacts that I'd forget the sequence of numbers and have to wait until my brain reset itself. And always, just outside my office, was the pent-up urgency of crisis, the cock trigger of a military machine always poised to attack anywhere, anytime, at the sound of a voice on the other end of a scrambled phone line, behind the soft-colored walls of an inner office, along the miles of corridors on the inner and outer ring. You think of the Pentagon as something of an amorphous entity with a single mindset and a single purpose. It's probably the same way most people think of the structure of the American military. One army, one goal, everybody marches together. But that's almost totally false. The American military and its home office, the Pentagon, is just like any other business, with hundreds of different bureaus, many in direct and explicit competition with each other for the same resources and with different agendas and tactical goals. The separate military branches have different goals when it comes to how America should be defended and wars fought, and it's not uncommon for differences to emerge even within the same branch of the service. I was plunged right into this in my first weeks back in D.C. Debates were still going on from World War II 16 years before, and all of this formed the backdrop of Roswell. There was a huge wrangling within the Navy between the aircraft carrier advocates from World War II and the submariners under Admiral Hyman Rickover, who saw the big flat tops as herds of elephants, slow, and vulnerable. Subs, on the other hand, running almost forever on nuclear fuel, could slip deep beneath the sea, lay 1,000 or so miles off enemy territory, and blast away at its most vulnerable targets with multiple warhead ICBMs. No way our enemies could escape destruction as long as we had our submarine fleet. So who needs another aircraft carrier with its screen of destroyers and other escorts when just one sub can deliver a knockout punch anywhere, anytime, without enemy orbiting intel satellites snapping pictures of its every move? Look what our subs did to the Japanese in the Pacific. Look what the German U-boats did to us in the Atlantic. But you couldn't convince the Navy brass of all that in the 1960s. Like the Navy, the Air Force had different advocates for different goals, and so did the Army. And when there are competing agendas and strategies articulated by some of the best and brightest people ever to graduate from universities, war colleges, and the ranks of officers, you have hard-nosed people playing high-stakes games against one another for the big prizes, the lion's share of the military budget. And at the very center of it all, the place where the dollars get spent, are the weapons development people who work for their respective branches in the military. And that's right where I was in the early days of 1961, shortly after John F. Kennedy came to town to begin his new administration. I had only just returned to Washington from the front lines of a war that nobody thought of as a real war, except for us, the guys who were there. It was easier during a real war like Korea. Your objective is to push the other guy back as far as you can, kill as many of his people as you can, and force him to surrender. You have a very pragmatic strategy. You try it, and if it works, you keep on doing it until it stops working. But on the front lines in Germany, where the battles were fought only with electron beams, threats, and feints, you had to assess how many soldiers might be killed, or how many planes you could bring down if the shooting were to start for real. For Americans, this was the Cold War, the combined military machines of two massive superpowers, each capable of obliterating each other the moment either one perceives a material weakness in the other's ability to retaliate. So you had a chess game played and replayed every day around the world in scores of different war rooms where different scenarios were formulated to see who would win. It was all a game of numbers and strategies with different armed services around the world winning and losing battles on computers. Very elegant and precise. But what very few people outside of government knew was the Cold War was really a hot war. Fought with real bullets, real casualties, only no one could step forward to admit it because the front lines were within the very government capitals of the countries that were fighting it. I saw this with my own eyes right here in Washington, where the war had been going on since 1947. So with the sides drawn and the tensions between the various bureaus and services within the Pentagon, it didn't take me long in those first few weeks to learn the politics of my new job. With the field reports, scientific analyses, medical autopsies, and technological debris from the Roswell crash I had under lock and key, my first rule was to be as circumspect as possible. Draw no attention to myself. I'd learned this skill when I served on MacArthur's staff in Korea 10 years earlier. I had to be the little man who wasn't there. If people don't think you're there, they talk. That's when you learn things. And within those first few weeks, I saw and learned a lot about how the politics of the Roswell discovery had matured over the 14 years since the crash and since the intense discussions at the White House after Eisenhower became president. Each of the different branches of the military had been protecting its own cache of Roswell-related files, and had been actively seeking to gather as much new Roswell material as possible. Certainly, all the services had their own reports from examiners at Walter Reed and Bethesda concerning the nature of the alien physiology. Mine were in my nut file, along with the drawings. It was pretty clear, also from the way the Navy and the Air Force were formulating their respective plans for advanced military technology hardware, that many of the same pieces of technology in my files were probably shared by the other services. But nobody was bragging, because everybody wanted to know what the other guy had. But since officially Roswell had never happened in the first place, there was no technology to develop. On the other hand, the curiosity among weapons and intelligence people within the services was rabid. Nobody wanted to come in second place in the silent, unacknowledged alien technology development race going on at the Pentagon as each service quietly pursued its version of a secret Roswell weapon. I didn't know what the Air Force or Navy had, or what they might have been developing from their respective files on Roswell, but I assumed each service had something and was trying to find out what I had. That would have been a good intelligence procedure. If you were in the know about what was retrieved from Roswell, you kept your ears open for snippets of information about what was being developed by another branch of the military, what was going on before the budget committees for funding, or what defense contractors were developing a specific technology for the services. If you weren't in the Roswell loop, but were too curious for your own good, you could be spun around by a swirling rumor mill that the Roswell race had kicked up among competing weapons development people in the services and wind up chasing nothing more than dust devils that vanished down the halls as soon as you turned the corner on them. There were real stories, however, that wouldn't go away no matter how many times somebody official stepped up to say the story was false. For example, I picked up a rumor pretty quickly concerning the UFO the Air Force was supposed to be keeping at Edwards Air Force Base in California and the research they were conducting on the spacecraft's technology, especially its electromagnetic wave propulsion system. There were also rumors circling around the Air Force about the early harvesting of Roswell technology in the design of the all-wing bombers. But I didn't know how much stock to put in them. The Army had been developing an all-wing design since right after World War I, and within a year after the Roswell crash, Jack Northrop's company began its test flights of their YB-49 flying wing recon bomber models. The YB-49's quadruple vertical tail fins were so uncannily reminiscent of the head-on Roswell craft sketches in our files that it was hard not to make a connection between the spacecraft and the bomber. But the flying wings development took place over 10 years before I got to the foreign technology desk, so I had no direct evidence relating the bomber to the spacecraft. General Trudeau was right, though, when he said that people at the Pentagon were watching Army R&D because they thought we were onto something. People wanted to know what foreign technology was working on, especially the more exotic things in our portfolio, just to make sure the memos read that we weren't duplicating budgetary resources by spending twice or three times for the same thing. There was a lot of talk and pressure from the Joint Chiefs of Staff about technology sharing and joint weapons development, but my boss wanted to keep what we had to ourselves, especially what he jokingly kept calling the alien harvest. As if the eyes of other military services weren't enough, we also had to contend with the analysts from the Central Intelligence Agency. Under the guise of coordination and cooperation, the CIA was amalgamating as much power as it could. Information is power, and the more the CIA tried to learn about the Army Weapons Development Program, the more nervous it made all of us at the center of R&D. Acquaintances of mine in the agency had dropped hints shortly after I took over the foreign technology desk that if I needed any intelligence about what other countries were developing, they could help me out. But one hand washes the other, and they dropped hints that if I had any clues about where any stray pieces of the cargo, or the package, as the Roswell artifacts were commonly referred to within the military, might be found, they would surely appreciate it if I could let them know. After the third time my CIA contacts bumped into me and whispered this proposal for exchanges of information into my ear, I told my boss that our friends might be anxious about what we had. "You really put me on the hot seat, General," I said to Trudeau over one of our morning briefings at the end of my first month on the job. I was still working on the strategy for the nut file and thankfully my boss hadn't pressed me yet to come up with recommendations for the plan, but it was coming. How does the CIA know what we have? They're guessing, I suppose, he said, and figuring it out by the process of elimination. Look, everybody suspects what the Air Force has. Trudeau was right. In the rumor bank from which everybody in the Pentagon made deposits and withdrawals, the Air Force was sitting on the Holy Grail, a spaceship itself, and maybe even a live extraterrestrial. Nobody knew for sure. We knew that after it became a separate branch of the military in 1947, the Air Force kept some of the Roswell artifacts at Wright Field outside of Dayton, Ohio, because that's where the cargo was shipped, stopping off in Fort Riley along the way. But the Air Force was primarily interested in how things fly, so whatever R&D they worked on was focused on how their planes could evade radar and outfly the Soviets, no matter where we got the technology from. And, he continued, I'm sure the agency fellows would love to get into the naval intelligence files on Roswell if they've not already done so. With its advanced submarine technology and missile-launching nuclear subs, the Navy was struggling with its own problem in figuring out what to do about UFOs, or USOs, unidentified submerged objects, as they came to be called. It was a worry in naval circles, primarily as war planners advanced strategies for protracted submarine warfare in the event of a first strike. Whatever was flying circles around our jets since the 1950s, evading radar at our top-secret missile bases like Red Canyon, which I saw with my own eyes, could plunge right into the ocean, navigate down there just as easily as you please, and surface halfway around the world without so much as leaving an underwater signature we could pick up. Were these USOs building bases at the bottom of oceanic basins beneath the dive capacity of our best submarines, even the Los Angeles-class Javis that were the only ones on the drawing boards? That's what the chief of naval operations had to find out, so the Navy was occupied with fighting its own war with extraterrestrial craft in the air and under the sea. That left the Army. But they don't know for sure what we have, Phil, Trudeau continued. He'd been talking the whole time. And they're busting a gut to find out. So we have to keep on doing what we do without letting them know what we have, General, I said. And that's what I'm working on. And I was. Even though I wasn't sure how we'd do it, I knew the business of R&D couldn't change just because we had Roswell crash artifacts in our possession. However we were going to camouflage our development of Roswell technology, it had to be within the existing way we did business, so no one would recognize any difference. We operated on a normal defense development project budget well into the billions in 1960, most of it allocated to the analysis of new weapon systems. Just within our own bureau, we had contracts with the nation's biggest defense companies with whom we maintained almost daily communication. A lot of the research we conducted was in the improvement of existing weapons based on the intelligence we received about what our enemies were pointing at us. Faster tanks, heavier artillery, improved helicopters, better tasting MREs. At the Foreign Technology Desk, we kept an eye on what other countries were doing, ally or adversary, and how we could adapt it to our use. The French, the Italians, the West Germans, all of them had their own weapon system and streams of development that seemed exotic by our standards, yet had certain advantages. The Russians had gotten ahead of us in liquid rocket propulsion systems and were using simpler, more efficient designs. My job was to evaluate the potential of the foreign technology and implement whatever we could. I'd get photos, designs, and specs of foreign weapon systems like the French helicopter technology, for example, and bring it to American contractors like Bell, Sikorsky, or Hughes to see whether we could develop aspects of it for our own use. And it was the perfect cover for protecting the Roswell technology, but we still had to figure out what we wanted to do with it. It couldn't simply stay in file cabinets or on shelves forever. What we had retrieved from the Roswell crash and had managed to hold on to was probably the most closely guarded secret the Army had, yet it was nothing more than an orphan. Up until 1961, the Army had come up with no plan to use the technology without revealing its nature or its source, and in so doing blow the cover on the biggest secret the government was keeping. There was no one bureau within the Army charged with managing Roswell and the other aspects of UFO encounters, as there was in the Air Force, and therefore nobody was keeping any public records of how the Army got its hands on its Roswell technology in the first place, and consequently no oversight mechanism. Everything up until 1961 was catch as catch can, but now it had to change. General Trudeau was looking for the grand endgame development scheme. It began with researching the history of how the whole file, the field reports, autopsy information, descriptions of the items found in the wreckage, and the bits and pieces of Roswell technology themselves came into the possession of Army R&D. Luckily enough for me, the whole Roswell story was still unknown outside the highest military circles in 1961. Retired Major Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer at the 509th who had been at the crash site in July 1947 and who had given the initial reports of a spacecraft, would not yet tell his story in public for at least another 10 years. Everyone else connected to the incident was either dead or sworn to silence. The Air Force, which moved quickly to take over the management of the Roswell affair and ongoing UFO contacts and sightings, still kept everything they learned highly classified under the Air Force Intelligence Command and waged a push-pull war with the CIA for information about sightings and ongoing contacts with anything extraterrestrial. These really weren't my concerns yet, but they would be. My research was not concerned with the crash at Roswell itself, nor at Corona, nor at San Augustine, if those crashes did in fact occur in early July 1947, but on the day after Roswell, the day Bill Blanchard from the 509th cratered up the alien debris and shipped it to Fort Bliss, where General Roger Ramey's staff determined its final disposition, and the official government history of the event began to unfold. In the early hours after the cargo arrived in Texas, there was so much confusion about what was found and what wasn't found that Army officers who were in charge of the entire retrieval operation quickly scraped together both cover story and a plan to silence all the military and civilian witnesses to the recovery. The cover story was easy. General Ramey ordered Major Jesse Marcel to recant his flying saucer story and pose for a news photo with debris from a weather balloon, which he described as the wreckage the retrieval team recovered from outside Roswell. Marcel followed orders, and the flying saucer officially became a weather balloon. The silencing of military witnesses was also accomplished easily enough through top-down orders from General Ramey to everyone at the 509th and at Fort Bliss to deny they were a part of any operation to recover anything other than a balloon. Once the material left Ramey's command and arrived at Lieutenant General Nathan P. Twining's Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, all General Ramey had to do was keep denying what he already was denying, and it was no longer his responsibility. Now it belonged to General Twining, from whose desk a whole new era of Army involvement with the Roswell material began. General Ramey treated the incident as a threat to national security and deployed whatever forces he could to bring the material back for evaluation and to suppress any rumors that might light a brush fire of panic. Therefore, Ramey used the counterintelligence personnel already posted to the 509th and ordered them deployed into the civilian community as well as the military to use any means necessary to suppress the story of the crash and retrieval. No news should be allowed to get out. No speculation was to be tolerated, and the story had to be quashed. By the next morning, July 8th, the suppression of the crash story was in full operation. The Army had already issued a new cover story to the press by the time CIC officers had gotten to the witnesses using threats and outright promises of cash forced them to recant their statements about what they saw. Rancher Mac Brazzo, who first said he had been at the site during the recovery and had described the strange debris, disappeared for 2 days, and then showed up in town driving a new pickup truck and denying he'd ever seen anything. CIC officers turned up at people's houses and spoke quietly to parents about what their children had learned. Whatever people thought was happening, Army personnel said, wasn't, and it would have to stay that way. You didn't see a thing, they ordered. Nothing happened here. Let me hear you repeat that. The silencing worked so well that for the next 30 years, the story seemed to have been swallowed up by the quiet emptiness of desert, where all things are worn down to a fine grade of sameness. But belying the quiet that settled over Roswell, 1,000 miles away, part of the U.S. military went on wartime alert as bits and pieces of the craft reached their destinations. One of those destinations, Lieutenant General Twining's desk at Wright Field, was the focal point from which the Roswell artifacts would reach the Foreign Technology Desk at the Pentagon. Among the first of the Army's top commands, notified of the events unfolding in Roswell in early July, would have had to have been Lieutenant General Twining's Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, where the Roswell debris was shipped. Nathan Twining has become important to UFO researchers because of his association with a number of highly secret meetings at the Eisenhower White House having to do with the national security issues posed by the discovery of UFOs and his relationship to National Security Special Assistant Robert Cutler, who was the liaison between the NSC and President Eisenhower when I was on the NSC staff in the 1950s. The silver-haired General Twining was the point man for initial research and dissemination of the Roswell-related material, and, partly because of the capability with which he administered the vital AMC at Wright, he became part of an ad hoc group of top military and civilian officials assembled by President Truman to advise him about the Roswell discovery and its national security implications. General Twining had been scheduled to travel to the West Coast in early July 1947, but he canceled the trip, remaining in New Mexico at the Army's airbase at Alamogordo until at least July 10th. Alamogordo was important, not just because it was the nation's nuclear weapons test site in the 1940s and the 1950s, but because it was also a field office of the AMC itself, where rocket scientist Wernher von Braun and others were primarily based. Close by was the White Sands Guided Missile Base, where some of our military's most advanced tracking and embryonic targeting radars were deployed. These were sensitive installations, especially during the UFO activity that week, and it made perfect sense that immediately after the recovery of the UFO, the Army general, whose responsibility it would have been to manage the retrieval, was almost directly on site conferring with his top scientists. Although I never saw the actual memos from President Truman to General Twining regarding his trip to New Mexico, I had heard stories about secret orders that Truman had issued to General Twining directing him to New Mexico to investigate the reports of the crash and to report directly to the White House on what he'd found. I believe that it was General Twining's initial report to the president that confirmed that the Army had retrieved something from the desert and might have suggested the need for the formation of an advisory group to develop policy about whatever was discovered. And remember, in those first 48 hours, nobody really knew what this was. By the time the Roswell debris had been shipped out of Fort Bliss and had arrived at Wright Field, General Twining had flown back from New Mexico to Wright to oversee the analysis and evaluation of the Roswell treasure trove. Twining moved quickly once back at his office. The alien bodies had to be autopsied in utmost secrecy, and the spacecraft and its contents analyzed, cataloged, and prepared for dissemination to various facilities within the military. Inasmuch as everything about the crash was given the highest security classification, stories had to be prepared for those with lower security classifications, but whose contributions could be important to the creation of a credible cover story. The official camouflage was almost as important to the military in 1947 as it was in 1961 when I took over. It was important because, as far as the Army was concerned, 1947 was still wartime, a Cold War perhaps, but a war nevertheless, and stories about military hardware as valuable as the material retrieved from Roswell could not be disclosed for fear that the Soviets would exploit it. Thus, from day one, the Army treated its retrieval of the debris as if it were an operation conducted in a wartime theater under battle conditions. Roswell became military intelligence. General Twining had seen the material for himself, and even before he returned to Wright Field, he conferred with the rocket scientists who were part of his brain trust at Alamogordo. Now, during the remainder of the summer months, he quietly compiled a report that he would deliver to President Truman and an ad hoc group of military, government, and civilian officials who would ultimately become the chief policymakers for what would become an ongoing contact with extraterrestrials over the ensuing 50 years. And as stories of the Roswell crash and other UFO sightings around U.S. military bases began to filter in through the command chain of the armed services, General Twining also needed to establish a lower security channel along which he could exchange information with other commands that were not cleared all the way to the top. General Twining still reported to higher-ups who, though they may not have had the security clearance he had with regard to the extraterrestrial contact, nevertheless were his commanding officers and routinely sought information from the AMC. Accordingly, General Twining needed to maintain a quasi-cover-up even within the military. The first of these reports was transmitted from General Twining to the commanding general of the Army Air Forces in Washington, dated September 23, 1947. Written to the attention of Brigadier General George Shulgin, Twining's memo addressed, in the most general of terms, the official Air Materiel's command intelligence regarding flying discs. He drew a remarkable number of conclusions, most of which I had to surmise when I was on Eisenhower's National Security Staff, and then again when I got to the Pentagon, where, based on Twining's own first-hand experience with the sighting reports from Roswell and other sighting reports as well as the materials themselves, which were in the military's possession. "Flying saucers or UFOs are not illusions," Twining says, referring to the sighting of strange objects in the sky as something real and not visionary or fictitious. Even though he cites the possibility that some of these sightings are only meteors or other natural occurrences, he says that the reports are based on real sightings of actual objects approximating the shape of a disc of such appreciable size as to be as large as man-made craft. Considering that this report was never intended for public scrutiny, especially in 1947, Twining marveled at the aircraft's operating characteristics and went on record drawing major conclusions about the material he had and the reports he'd heard or read. But when he wrote that the extreme maneuverability of the aircraft and their evasive actions when sighted or contacted by friendly aircraft and radar led him to believe they were either manually, automatically, or remotely flown, he not only suggested a guided flight, but imparted a hostile intent to their evasive maneuvers to avoid contact. His characterization of the aircraft's behavior revealed, even weeks after the physical encounter, that those officers in the military who were now running the yet-to-be-codenamed Extraterrestrial Contact Project already considered these objects and those entities who control them a military threat. He described the aircraft as it had been reported in the sightings, a light, reflective, or metallic surface, absence of a trail, except in those few instances where the object was operating under high-performance conditions. Circular, or elliptical in shape, flat on bottom, and domed on top. flights in formation consisting of from 3 to 9 objects, and no sound except for those instances when a substantial rumbling roar was noted. The objects moved quickly for aircraft at that time, he noted to General Shulgin, at level flight speeds above 300 knots. Were the United States to build such an aircraft, especially one with a range of over 7,000 miles, the cost commitment, administrative and development overhead, and drain on existing high-technology projects required that the entire project should be independent or outside of the normal weapons development bureaucracy. In other words, as I interpreted the memo, Twining was suggesting to the commander of the Army Air Force that were the Air Force, which would become a separate branch of the military by the following year, to attempt to exploit the technology that had quite literally dropped into its lap, it had to do so separately and independent from any normal weapons development program. The descriptions of the super-secret projects at Nellis Air Force Base, or Area 51, in the Nevada desert seemed to fit the profile of the kind of recommendation that General Twining was making, especially the employment of the Skunk Works group at Lockheed in the development of the stealth fighter and B-2 bomber. Not revealing to the Army Air Force's command that Twining himself had been ordered to visit bases in New Mexico in the hours after the crash, the general advised his bosses that the military should consider whether the flying discs were of domestic origin, the product of some high-security project already developed by the United States outside of normal channels, or developed by a foreign power that has a form of propulsion, possibly nuclear, which is outside of our domestic knowledge. At the same time, weaving a cover story that takes him out of the loop of reporting any of these flying discs as a first-hand observer, Twining writes that there is a lack of physical evidence in the shape of crash-retrieved exhibits, which would undeniably prove the existence of these objects. But even though General Twining has just written that there is no evidence, he nevertheless recommends to his superiors that Headquarters Army Air Forces issue a directive assigning a priority security classification and code name for a detailed study of this matter to include the preparation of complete sets of all available and pertinent data, which will then be made available to the Army, Navy, Atomic Energy Commission, JRDB, the Air Force Scientific Advisory Group, NACA, the RAND and NEPA projects for comment and recommendations, with a preliminary report to be forwarded within 15 days of receipt of the data and a detailed report thereafter every 30 days as the investigation develops. A complete interchange of data should be effected. This was an important part of the memo, at least for me and my research into how the Army got the Roswell file, because it accounted for the Army's dissemination of the Roswell materials and accompanying reports within only a couple of months after the materials' arrival at Wright Field. When General Twining suggested to his commanding officers at AAF that all the military branches as well as existing government and civilian commissions needed to share this information, the dispersal of materials was already underway. This is how the technology came into the possession of Army R&D. Finally, the general promised to the Army Air Force's command that the Air Materiel Command would continue to investigate the phenomenon within its own resources in order to define its nature further, and would route any more information it developed through channels. 3 days after the memo, on September 26, 1947, General Twining gave his report on the Roswell crash and its implications for the United States to President Truman and a short list of officials he convened to begin the management of this top-secret combination of inquiry, police development, and ops. This working group, which included Admiral Roscoe H. Hillenkoetter, Dr. Vannevar Bush, Secretary James Forrestal, General Hoyt Vandenberg, Dr. Detlev Bronk, Dr. Jerome Hunsaker, Sidney V. Sowers, Gordon Gray, Dr. Donald Menzel, General Robert M. Montague, Dr. Lloyd V. Berkner, and General Nathan Twining himself became the nucleus for an ongoing 50-year operation that some people have called Majestic 12. At the Eisenhower White House, it was simply referred to as the Group, and in the days after Roswell, it went into operation just as smoothly as slipping your new 1949 Buick with its Dynaflow automatic transmission into drive and pulling away from the curb. In this way, General Twining had carefully orchestrated a complete cover-up of what had happened at Roswell, as well as a full-scale, top-secret military R&D operation to identify the nature of the phenomenon and assess its military threat to the United States. It was as elegant as it was effective. But the plan didn't stop with the creation of the working group. In fact, the operation very quickly developed into something far more sophisticated because General Twining's flying discs simply wouldn't go away. As more information on sightings and encounters came rolling in through every imaginable channel, from police officers taking reports, from frightened civilians to airline pilots tracking strange objects in the sky, the group realized they needed policies on how to handle what was turning into a mass media phenomenon. They needed a mechanism for processing the thousands of flying saucer reports that could be anything from a real crash or close encounter to a couple of bow hunks tossing a pie tin into the air and snapping its picture with their Aunt Harriet's Kodak Brownie. The group also had to assess the threat from the Soviet Union and the Iron Curtain countries, assuming, of course, that flying saucers weren't restricted to North America, and gather intelligence on what kinds of information our allies had on flying discs as well. And it still had to process the Roswell technology and figure out how it could be used. So from the original group, there developed a whole tree structure of loosely confederated committees and subgroups, sometimes complete organizations like the Air Force Project Blue Book, all kept separate by administrative firewalls so that there would be no information leakage, but all controlled from the very top. With the initial and ongoing stories safely covered up, the plans for long-term reverse engineering work on the Roswell technology could begin. But who would do it? Where would the materials reside? And how could the camouflage of what the military was doing be maintained amidst the push for new weapons, competition with the Soviets, and the flying saucer mania that was sweeping the country in the late 1940s? General Twining had a plan for that, too. Just over a year after the initial group meetings at the White House, Air Force Intelligence, now that the Air Force had become a separate service, issued a December 1948 report, 100-203-79, called Analysis of Flying Object Incidents in the U.S., in which UFOs are never referred to as extraterrestrial objects, but as elements of foreign technology, which is actually the subject of the report. The report, innocuous to most people because it doesn't say that flying saucers came from outer space, is actually one of the first indications showing how the camouflage plan was supposed to work over the ensuing years. The writers of the report had located within the existing military administrative structure the precise place where all the research and development into the flying disc phenomenon could be pursued, not only under a veil of secrecy, but in the very place where no one could be expected to look, the Foreign Technology Desk. Here the materials could be deposited for safekeeping within the military while Army and Air Force brass decided what our existing industrial and research technology allowed them to do. There could be fiascos as weapons failed, secret experiments without fear of exposure, and most importantly, an ongoing discussion of how the United States could develop this treasure trove of engineering information all within the very structure where it was supposed to take place. Just don't call it extraterrestrial. Call it foreign technology and throw it into the hopper with the rest of the mundane stuff that the foreign technology officers were supposed to do. And that's how, 12 years later, the Roswell technology turned up in an old combination locked military file cabinet carted into my new Pentagon office by two of the biggest enlisted men I'd ever seen. Chapter 5, The Cover-Up. While General Twining was flying back and forth from Ohio to New Mexico on the other side of the world in Moscow, Chairman Joseph Stalin was furious. Red-faced and not even trying to hide the rage that erupted like an exploding volcano, Stalin held up a copy of the Roswell Daily Record for Tuesday, July 8, 1947, and threw it out onto the center of the table for any of the scientists in the room who could read English. Stalin didn't need an American newspaper to tell him what his NKVD agents on the ground at Alamogordo had reported weeks before, that a U.S. Army retrieval team had pulled a crashed alien spacecraft out of the New Mexico desert and was already evaluating the valuable technology they'd recovered. At first, when the Soviet intelligence bosses got the report from their agents at the American bases, they were more than skeptical. They figured the stories were plants, false information to flush out the Soviet spies the Americans suspected had infiltrated their most secret bases. If the Soviet government reacted to the disinformation, the American counterintelligence agents would be able to determine the path of the story and isolate the spies. But when newspapers began reporting the crash, then covered it up with stories about weather balloons, the Soviets knew they had stumbled onto the real thing. So it was true, Stalin told the group. The Americans had actually gotten their own flying saucer. Now, he asked, what would they do with it? One of the chief designers of the Soviets' embryonic liquid fuel rocket program was at the meeting. He, like many of the Soviet engineers who'd read the German secret weapons files at the end of the war, knew exactly where the Americans should have been in their guided missile development program. What information his bosses in the Kremlin thought he still needed to know, they gave him from the reports they received from agents in the field. But nothing, nothing about the V-2 launches at White Sands, nothing about the new tracking radars at Alamogordo gave the scientists in the Soviet rocket program any indications that the Americans were even an iota ahead of them in guided missiles until he heard the news of the Roswell crash. Both the Russian and American missile programs were based almost entirely upon the German weapons research spoils that the Allies were dividing up even before the end of the war. I was a first-hand participant in this, secreting out German weapons scientists through Italy after we occupied Rome as part of a secret operation codenamed Paperclip that began in 1944. With V-2 designers Wernher von Braun and others running experiments on the German missiles we brought back to the United States, the Army had successfully appropriated much of the German advanced weapons research and was carrying on experiments in New Mexico. The Soviets also got their own share of German technology through their own intelligence agents and local Communist Party cells in occupied countries. And what a technology it was! The Germans had developed a crescent-shaped jet-powered flying wing, jet-powered Messerschmitts that blazed by our own P-51s as if they were standing still, and a U-boat-launched V-1 V-2 that, had the Germans been able to hide even a small flotilla off the American East Coast, could have bombed out much of heavily concentrated downtown Washington in a matter of hours. All they needed to buy was enough time to deploy their weapons and get their U-boats in position, and that was their strategy toward the end of 1944 when they turned around and counterattacked through Belgium in the dead of winter and pinned us down at the Battle of the Bulge. Break our advance on the ground, blast us out of the air with their jets, bomb North American cities, knock Britain out of the war. With their new weapons, they could have fought us to a standstill and won a bitter truce. Both the Americans and the Soviets wanted to get their hands on those German weapons, especially the V-2s. Stalin didn't have to worry much about who held the advantage in German weaponry after the war. Both sides were about equal. But this flying saucer crash, that was a different matter, and it meant that in an instant, The United States could have gained an enormous advantage in the Cold War weapons race that had begun only moments after the Germans surrendered. What might that advantage be? The Russian liquid fuel engineer wondered aloud. What could the Americans have retrieved from that?